Haas versus Commonwealth, Craig S. Cooley, Appellant's Counsel, Eugene P. Murphy, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Appellee's Counsel.
Where is Mr. Murphy? There he is. All right. Mr. Cooley, you may proceed.
I point out to the court that this was a case almost purely on credibility. There were originally three counts of rape that went forward in this trial. The jury elected to acquit on two of the three and convicted on the two remaining issues that are now before the court. This is a case where the defense sought to put on the aunt of the complainant, Ms. Dulgarian. The aunt's name is Tammy Odom Barber, and Ms. Barber had allowed her sister, who's the mother of the complainant and the complainant's sister, the three of them, to live with her at her residence. And at some point in time decided that they needed to go have their own location and suggested that. And when she made that suggestion, her sister started screaming at her that she was turning her back on the family. And at that point in time, the complainant in this case, Ms. Dulgarian, told Ms. Barber, if you don't do what my mom wants, I'll just go say Scott. And Scott is Ms. Barber's boyfriend, now husband. I will just go say Scott put his hands on me. Barber says that they were never alone together. They had never been alone together. So she said, why are you going to tell a lie like that piece? And complained, well, done it for, and I would do it again. And my mom could take me to the magistrate, and that would be the end of it. This complaint case, Haas had accused two other guys of sexual assault. Ms. Barber is telling that bird that Chad, that one of the other two people accused, saying Chad never get that response. Ms. Barber was one of you, but I did. It is a matter of the trial of fact admissible. The trial kept to, as did the Commonwealth's attorney, as evidence of a prior fall act.
Mr. Cooley, will you stop for just a moment?
Yes.
Can the IT department connected to this particular case help with Mr. Cooley's video and audio enough for us to be able to hear him? Hold on just a moment.
Chief Justice, looks like there's a significant amount of packet loss.
Vision that the credibility of a witness may be impeached by any party other than the one calling the witness with any proof that is relevant to the witness's credibility. Impeachment may be taken among other means, and it then goes on to list a total of eight different things that aren't exclusive, but are a list that includes some things that could be used. And Roman numeral 8 says any other evidence that is probative on the issue of credibility because of a logical tendency to convince the trier of fact that the witness's perception, memory, or narration is defective or impaired, or that the sincerity or veracity of the witnesses is questionable. So they determine by using a non-exclusive method, that being the previous false accusation, which is never the way we characterize this, as being the only test of whether this could be admitted. And I point out that this court, in the case that the
court relied upon and that the Attorney General relies upon in the Kleinbell case twice says, and I'm quoting from pages 224 in the first instance, this court said, in sex offense cases, however, the weight of authority recognizes more liberal rules concerning impeachment of complaining witnesses. And it said the same thing at page 325 of Kleinbell. It started off with, at least in the context of prosecutions of sexual offenses, evidentiary restraints must sometimes yield to a defendant's right of cross-examination.
Mr. So Cooley, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may interrupt you for a moment.
Certainly.
May I ask you to focus on the... Well, first off, the defendant was convicted of one count of rape. Am I right?
That is correct.
Not two, not three, but one count of rape.
He was acquitted of two and convicted of the third.
All right. So on the one count of rape, why isn't the DNA evidence dispositive? The victim's DNA, the defendant's DNA... are in a mixture on a bed that she said the rape happened. He claimed he never went into the building at all and obviously claimed he didn't have anything to do with raping her. And even after a court ordered him to give up his DNA, it had to be forcibly taken from him because he refused to cooperate with the court's search warrant order. So the conviction, there is solid DNA evidence that corroborates the victim's testimony. So maybe she exaggerated in theory about other things, but on that particular thing, why in the world would we order a retrial even if you were right?
Well, I think your assessment of the evidence is incorrect.
Okay, tell me why.
The expert said that while it is true that DNA from two different people, including the defendant, was in that location, you cannot say, and he could not say, that it was put there at the same time. There were 70 some stains on this sheet. Apparently, Ms. Delgarian's mother never changed sheet and had a good deal of sexual activity on that bed. There were 70 some stains. And they tested a number of them that contained, I think, a total of three different men's DNA. And what the expert said was, it was possible that Ms. Delgarian had made a deposit there, and at some later time, Mr. Haas made a deposit there. Or vice versa.
Am I right? Didn't the defendant outright deny ever depositing anything, much less his DNA, on that bed?
But he denied that he had had sex with her on that bed. He denied he had sex with her at all. He acknowledged that he had had some sexual activity with her mother. In fact, said that was the first time they had met, and that she had oral sex with him. And he was not sure what she did with the towel and such in which his ejaculate had been placed. So he didn't know if that was thrown on the bed or whatever. So as to that, secondly, we were not allowed to argue the second issue about the, if the court goes back to look at our brief in the Court of Appeals on the second question you raise, and that is relating to the refusal of giving DNA, you will see that the trial judge on one occasion told Mr. Haas that he had an absolute right to refuse to give DNA. And then a number of hearings after that, and there's a real question, and that's fully briefed in our original brief to the Court of Appeals, and believe in the initial brief to this court, it shows that Mr. Haas was still laboring under the impression that he'd been told he had a constitutional right to refuse. And then the court allowed it to be introduced. That was probably our second strongest point in this appeal. I'm not sure if that meets your answer.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you, Mr. Cooley.
Mr. Cooley, the Clifford and Kleinville cases talk about if an accuser's made an accusation, if that's an issue, then the court has to make a threshold determination that there was a reasonable probability that the prior accusations were false. How do you deal with that statement of the court that the evidence was insufficient to allow, as a predicate, to allow this evidence, the aunt's testimony, into this case?
Well, again, I think they are using the wrong calculus. The trial judge and the Court of Appeals are trying to force this into a single and non-exclusive basis of admissibility. We never suggested that this was a false statement, a previous false statement. This is direct and in my opinion, affirmative evidence. She is not saying, yeah, I made a false statement once before in the sense of this is a provable or not. She is saying, I have lied before in this context, and I will lie again. And then that is an affirmative statement of her mindset. It goes directly to the rule, both the general rule, but specifically the Roman numeral 8. That goes directly to her sincerity or veracity. And she makes a statement to somebody that I have lied before and I will lie again. I've done it before, I'll do it again. And is saying I will just go make a false statement against him. The court may or may not think, if it was the trier of fact judging this, it would be up to the court to decide the credibility of Ms. Barber. But it's the trier of fact that should have decided that, not the court in this case. He saw it as a case of admissibility because he tried to force it into this one exception of a prior false accusation. But that's not the exclusive basis, and this falls under the general rule and under Roman numeral 8 as a basis for admissibility. Now, I do not know how a average person, a juror, would have looked at this other than she was saying, I've lied before and I will lie again. And she's, all of this is in the context of her telling her aunt that she is prepared to go accuse the aunt's boyfriend, then husband now, of sexually assaulting her. And I think that was the prerogative of the trier of fact, not the trial judge. He let it in, and as this court knows, we tried this case twice. And the second day, when the jury was about to come back with a verdict, we discovered that the deputies had accidentally given them exhibits that had been excluded. And so we had a mistrial. The second time around, the trial judge decided he wasn't going to let it in. And he used this kind of pigeonholing it in a single option rather than using the general rule and subsection 8, Roman numeral 8.
You have 46 seconds left.
May I preserve it?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Mr. Murphy?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Gene Murphy for Commonwealth. One of the reasons why the judge decided this case, at least in part, on the false allegations of sexual abuse, was that the defendant has always framed his question, the most important issue in the case, both here and in the trial court, as error in failing to permit him to introduce evidence that the victim had lied before and will lie again in the context of an alleged sexual abuse. And I think the judge thought, well, wait a minute, you're talking about something's happened with respect to alleged sexual abuse, and you're talking about her having lied before. And it seemed very much to him, even though the defendant denied it, that we were dealing with false allegations of sexual abuse. And so he proceeded to determine under Kleinbell that there was no finding, no evidence at all of any falsehood with respect to Chad, the alleged prior false allegation. Chad had done exactly what she said he had done, that he had touched her on the thigh. Of course, that wasn't a criminal act, so it wasn't prosecuted. But there's no dispute that she said nothing false about him and never said anything about the husband, the now husband, and never made a false allegation later on. So we have
Mr.
no
Murphy,
false
this is Justice Kelsey. May I interrupt you with a question?
Sure. Yes,
suppose,
sir.
Can I change the facts and ask you a hypothetical? Suppose the victim had simply said to the aunt, you know what, when it comes to sexual assault, I'm willing to lie about it in the future. With no context at all, just that statement, I'm willing to lie about sexual abuse involving me in the future, quote, end quote. If that were the only statement, would the Kleinbell line of authorities be relevant?
I'm not sure it would, but I think what would be relevant would be 608, which says that you cannot have just one incident of untrustworthiness to prove to attack credibility.
But that's the reputation rule, right?
Well, Your Honor, it's been applied whenever there's been an allegation of untruthfulness, as in Gamache, which was one of the cases upon which 608 was based, was that, in fact, you couldn't use any single incident of any kind to, with respect
I may be wrong, Mr. Murphy, you correct me if I am, but my understanding of reputation rule is reputation in the eyes or minds of others. But if the individual who announces his or her intention, how can that be anything but admissible if it were not in the context that it was presented in here? And then to cut to the chase, why wouldn't the right analysis be you use Kleinbell on half of this remark, but you allow the other half of the remark come in without Kleinbell because it's a mixed remark. It has a past tense reference to a prior event, and it has a future reference unconnected to anything specifically. So I see a nuance here, and I don't know that I'm hearing a lot of help on making it sensible.
The court went into that. Not only did it find no false allegation of rape or sexual abuse, it found that the defendant had not established that she intended to lie about anything. What she said was that I have done it before and I will do it again. And what she had done before was to tell the truth about what Chad had done. So it seems
let me cut to the chase. It's 607. And 608 do not apply to the second half of this mixed statement, the future intent. Assume, without waiving or conceding, 607 and 608 don't bar it. Then why would the trial judge be making any threshold analysis of anything in terms of credibility? That's not the way evidence works.
Because, I mean, what you're saying is that she said that she intended to do this. But he said she didn't intend to lie. She intended, again, to report truthful occasions of sexual abuse or sexual touching. That she never
indicated. Well, that's just the trial judge interpreting the evidence. Why is the trial judge interpreting the evidence anyway?
Well,
obviously, you've
got to
do under Kleinbell, but there's no threshold requirement. If you just come in and said, this is what he said, Judge, whether you think it means what I think it means, that's not my problem. The jury gets to make this call.
Well, I think it wouldn't make any sense if, in fact, what we're talking about is a truthful statement. There's no evidence that she said she would testify falsely in the future. I think that what makes it differently from your hypothetical. To have a situation where we're not sure what it is when she says, I did it before and I will do it again, the judge thought it wouldn't be reasonable to interpret that to mean she had stated, she had told her aunt that she would lie in the future.
Well, why is that the trial judge's decision anyway? I would have thought the trial judge, If you'd only heard the second half of the statement, I would have thought the trial judge would say, huh, I don't think I'd believe that if this were a bench trial, but whatever, we'll see what the jury thinks.
Well, but of course, you didn't have just the second half, you had both. And it seems to me that without the first half, you don't know what she intends by her second statement, that I did it before and I will do it again. But if she hasn't lied before, I'm not sure how, the judge couldn't understand how you could that then read that as a intention to lie.
So logically then, I think I'm understanding it, but I want you to tell me I'm wrong if you think I'm wrong. If 607, or for that matter 608, barred the prior context, i.e. I lied in the past in this or that or the other scenario, let's assume it does, then your understanding then is the extrapolation that the witness herself made, which is, well, I intend to lie in the future about this same subject matter, that can't be surgically taken off and independently analyzed?
I don't know. That did not happen. I don't see how it could have been separately analyzed in the situation. The judge was trying to figure out what it was that she meant when she said she would do it again, and what he discovered she had done before did not involve any false statements. So and it seems to me that then it's a straight attack on credibility, and it seems to me that 608 then does become important. If you're relying, the only thing you're relying upon is one incident of untrustworthiness, that wouldn't be admissible to prove a lack of credibility.
I'm with you on that with respect to 607. I'm not trying to blunt your argument on that. The problem that I'm having in this argument is the outright statement, unqualified, of an intent to lie on the general subject matter in the future. And I'm struggling to understand how 607 can be used to preclude that part of the statement.
Well, I'm also struggling
with harmless error. I hope you get to that before your time ends.
All right. Let me say first that the important to the determination also is that there's not a statement just like what happened later on. The defendant says it's important because it's just like the crime that you're dealing with at Haas. This was at most a statement that she would say that someone had touched her. There's no indication whatsoever that she ever said or intended to say that she'd been raped by anybody, Scott or Chad. So it seems to me it's of limited relevance when we're trying to determine whether she lied later about a rape. But I think that 607 tells you how you can attack credibility, and that it then says you may use any of these ways, but when you use those, you may not use individual separate transactions.
Counsel, this is Justice Mims. Why doesn't 607A8 apply here? Your opposing counsel has mentioned that, and 607A8 is not included in the Court of Appeals opinion. So what? Should we be looking at A8?
607-8, I think, is also governed by, 607-8 is also governed by 608. And I didn't cite it in my brief, but there was a similar, that issue was addressed in the Castillo case, where they said that you still had to comply with the restriction under 608 about individual separate single events. And that, that for that reason, it would still not be available to admit the evidence.
But why isn't 607A4 applicable to the remark about a past lie and 607A8 applicable to the statement of future intent?
It might very well be applicable, but I think it is still covered by 608. That if you are attacking credibility, and what you're offering is one incident of untrustworthiness, you are foreclosed from that by 608. But I do want to get to the harmless error Because first of all, the defendant misstates what happened with respect to the DNA refusal. The DNA refusal was upheld because subsequent...
Ms. Murphy?
Yes.
Before you get to the harmless error, in 607, 1 and 2, 1 and 3 are cabined specifically by 608, but 8 is not. 607A8 is not cabined by 2:608. So wouldn't that indicate that 607A8 is a broader, more general application of what it says? Anything that calls into question the sincerity or the veracity of the witness is admissible. And also, isn't a statement in some respects different from the conduct that 608A(b) discusses?
Well, I mean, the statement is, of course, conduct under 608. Gamache, I believe, was what the witness has said. And I think that, as I say, I can't find any authority other way on this 608's application to 607, except in the Castillo case, where they addressed that at length. And in footnote 38, specifically said that 608 did apply to 607, and that they would have to look to 608 before they could decide whether the 607 permitted the admission.
Thank you. You may go back to your other argument.
With respect to the DNA refusal, what happened was that we found in the record an order of a hearing subsequent to the time when the defendant was told by the court they did not have to submit. He was subsequently told in court, before he was forced to provide the sample, that he was required under the law to do so, and he was directed by the court to provide that sample. So he didn't do it thinking he was entitled to refuse. He did it after he had been told to comply by the judge. And that's probably why this court didn't grant that issue, because it was clear from the Court of Appeals' opinion that there was nothing, he had no defense at all, and that it's clearly proved his unwillingness. It was very powerful evidence of his guilt. And I think additionally, with respect to the harmless error, because of the confusion about what was said and what was done, that even if that evidence were admitted, it would not have made any difference in light of the strength of the case against Mr. Haas. So I think what we have is clear harmless error, and I believe because, you know, the defendant never specifically cited a specific site at trial or rule of law, it was unclear exactly what he was arguing. And the court attempted to deal with what he might have raised, but was clearly found there was no false allegation. So any reliance on anything that is false, I think, is gone, and which basically precludes him from arguing that she's just untrustworthy because she lies about sexual abuse. And unless there are further questions, I'll ask that the decision below be affirmed.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Cooley, rebuttal?
46 seconds, Your Honor. There is an issue, and I note this goes to the fact that she says, I've lied before. There was a very quick question. Excuse me, I'm getting some feedback. I'm going to step away. This young lady made this accusation of both Mr. Potts and a fellow named Justin Moore. She did that when her mother burst into the doctor's office when Ms. Delgarian told the doctor that she was sexually active, and mother was listening at the door, burst in and started fussing at her, in which time she said, well, they were your friends, and she named Mr. Potts and Mr. Moore. Mr. Moore's response when he found out about the accusation was to go to the police and demand that he be polygraphed and whatever else they could do, that this was a false accusation. The trial judge did not let that testimony in. Mr. Moore was there and happy to testify. The trial judge found that that was a previous false accusation, allegation by us, and prohibited. But that doesn't mean it couldn't have been allowed. Thank you very much, and I appreciate your
listening. All right, don't hang up just yet.
I shan't.
Don't hang up.
I will not.
All right. You know, from time to time, you have the opportunity to commend counsel for what is a really helpful presentation to the court. And I know that I speak for myself and for others that on the court that we've always appreciated the manner in which both of you have been prepared for arguments like this, very serious argument like this, and the manner in which you've handled it. But both of you, very professional, courteous, and civil. And I can't let the moment go by without making that observation about both of you. In addition to that, I have it on fairly good authority that Mr. Murphy, this may be your last argument before the court. Am I right about that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you're going into retirement?
Yes.
Well, I also understand that if you count up the number of years that, you tell me if I'm right, you've been at the Attorney General's office doing this kind of work, making these kinds of arguments before the court for 36 years, am I right?
Right, well, I'm now in my 37th, yes.
37th year. Well, we appreciate your work before the court, your work and the manner in which you've done it, and we wish you the best as you go off into your retirement. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, the court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Your Honor.